If you want to go ahead and start turning, we're going to begin today in 1 Kings chapter 19, but the majority of our text is going to deal with 2 Kings chapter 8. I just want to remind us of one small point before we get there. Now, let me ask you the question, what do you think of when you hear the phrase, the hands of God? The hands of God. For many, it probably recalls something in regards to God's providential movements over a situation. When looking at a disaster that was averted or a life change, somebody comes to know the Lord, a extreme case where a conversion takes place, someone might say, I could see the hands of God at work. I think of His providential care. I think of His sovereignty. But when I hear the phrase, the hands of God, you know, I think of something slightly different. A different image comes to my mind. I think of the movie Frailty. Have any of y'all seen the movie Frailty? Didn't think you would have. It's a movie that came from the early 2000s, maybe 2001, starring Matthew McConaughey, Bill Paxton. In the movie, Bill Paxton, it's following an FBI agent, really, looking for this Bill Paxton character and his family. It's the FBI search for a serial killer who calls himself God's Hands. It's the God's Hands killer. And Paxton's character believes that God is asking him to dispatch with certain people who look like people but are actually demons. Or so he believes. And the movie, of course, is fiction, but it's not too far from an actual historical account, which we'll begin to cover today and we'll continue to cover next week. So if you go ahead and look at 1 Kings chapter 19, we're going to set the stage for this. The royal line has been infected in Israel with Baal worship for some time now. It was infected when the woman Jezebel appeared from the scene, that Sidonian princess, the Gentile who worshipped a pagan god. And of course, she brought that pagan worship in whenever she married the king of Israel. Okay, he wanted to follow her. He began worshiping. Now, at where we're at in the story, through marriage, this infection has actually spread to the Davidic line in the southern kingdom of Judah. And, as J. Vernon McGee says, when you have the devil as your father-in-law, he's going to see to it that you have trouble. It's going to spell trouble for the northern kingdom. It's going to spell trouble for the southern kingdom. You may recall when we were following the prophet Elijah, that towards the end of his tenure, the Lord asked him, he gave him the task with anointing three individuals. And that's what we pick up with in chapter 19. Elijah was running from this woman Jezebel. He has just executed the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. She's upset about it. She is after his life. So he takes off. He's running. He goes and visits the Lord on Mount Sinai. And he's crying out to the Lord. The Lord asks him in chapter 19, the end of verse 13, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah answers. He says, I've been very zealous for the Lord, Yahweh, the God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And Yahweh says to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael the king of, as king over Aram. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall come about, the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Now, when we were following Elisha in the story, we saw Elijah in the story, we saw him anoint Elisha. He gets right to it. He does it right after this, right? And Elisha follows Elijah around and he teaches him. But we never saw Elijah anoint Hazael or Jehu. And he's been taken up at this point in the chariots of fire. Now, what happened here? Why didn't he go up to Damascus and anoint a new king over Aram? You may recall, just a chapter or two later in 1 Kings 21, Ahab's positive response to Elijah's chastisement in the vineyard, Naboth's vineyard, gave him a stay of execution. Listen to it. Chapter 21, I'm going to start in verse 20 and read to verse 29. Okay? Ahab comes and he finds Elijah in Naboth's vineyard, which he thinks he's about to purchase because Jezebel's had him wiped out. He says to Elijah, "Have you found me, O my enemy?" And Elijah answers, "I have found you, because you've sold yourself to do evil in the sight of Yahweh. Behold, I will bring evil upon you and utterly sweep you away and will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free in Israel. And I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat," that was the first of the northern kings, "and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah," that's the second dynasty, "because of the provocation with which you provoked me to anger and because you have made Israel sin. Of Jezebel also Yahweh has spoken, saying, 'The dogs will eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel. The one belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. The one who dies in the field, the birds of heaven will eat. Surely there is no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of Yahweh, because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. He acted very abominably, and following idols according to all that the Amorites had done, whom Yahweh cast out before the sons of Israel.'" Now look at this. "It came about, when Ahab heard these words, that he tore his clothes, and he put on sackcloth and fasted, and he lay in sackcloth and went about despondently. And then the word of Yahweh came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, 'Do you see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but I will bring the evil upon his house in his son's days.'" He's gotten a stay of execution. It's still coming. Judgment is coming. Not while Ahab lives. Not this judgment, at least. But Ahab died years ago. He's been gone. And Jezebel is still alive and well on planet Earth. She's still walking around wrecking the scene. They see her as the queen mother. She still has political influence and authority. And at this point, the hands of God are going to be set in motion. And that's what we're picking up with in 2 Kings chapter 8. So take a moment. Turn to 2 Kings chapter 8. We're going to pick up in verse 7. We find Elisha in verse 7, chapter 8 of 2 Kings. Elisha came to Damascus. Wonder who's there. Now, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was sick. And it was told him, saying, "The man of God has come here." And the king said to Hazael, "Take a gift in your hand and go and meet the man of God and inquire of Yahweh by him, saying, 'Will I recover from this sickness?'" Now, this is following a 7-year period of famine in Israel. And Elisha is now visited by the servant of the king of Aram. He's gone over to Damascus. You're saying, who is this king Ben-Hadad? Is this the same king that last week we saw in the very last chapter besieged Israel and the Lord chased him and his entire army away? Yeah, it's the same king. Is this the same king that 2 chapters ago was seeking Elisha's life? That he sent a whole army of a marauding band to go take just Elijah out? And then the Lord averted that? Yeah, it's the same king. So, what's going on here? Now, a couple weeks ago, we read about Ahab's first son. Okay, Ahab and Jezebel's eldest son, his name was Ahaziah. You remember? He took over for Ahab after Ahab was killed in battle. And he was walking around on the roof of his palace, and he fell through the lattice, and he became ill. And he wanted to know, am I going to survive this illness? Who did he seek counsel to find out if he was going to survive the illness? Listen to it. This is in the opening chapter of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 2. Ahaziah fell through the lattice of his upper chamber, which was in Samaria, and became ill. So he sent messengers and said to them, go inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, whether I will recover from this sickness. The king of Israel is seeking the god of Ekron. He's seeking the Baals. Not this Gentile king. The Gentile who lives in the land that serves the Baals. The Gentile king wants to know, what does Yahweh say? He knows there's a prophet of God in Israel. He's had enough experience with this prophet, at least at this point. Now, this is an interesting fact in salvation history, really. You know, today, Gentiles are coming to faith en masse. Are Jews coming to faith en masse? No. It's a really interesting thing. You see it happening in the Old Testament, but really in the New Testament, it starts to explode. And then we have 1900 years of church history that really just doesn't make any sense when you think about it. Did you place your faith and trust in Jesus Christ because you knew the Old Testament and you recognized that He was the promised fulfillment of the God of Israel coming out of the Old Testament? Or did you read the book of John and found yourself believing? Most of us either grew up in a church family and this is just what you believe, and then now it's faith-seeking understanding, right? I know I believe that Jesus is Messiah. Now I'm trying to find out, what does that mean? Well, we'll give people the Gospel of John. We'll find out. These Gentiles read it and they believe, but they don't have a clue what the Messiah is. I'm a sinner. Christ died for my sins. I believe. But the Jews, who know the information, who have the Old Testament, we find rejecting. It's ridiculous, really. It's the miracle of faith that's the Holy Spirit's work, especially in our present age, convicting the world of sin, of righteousness, of judgment. Think about it. For 1900 years, Gentiles are believing that a dead king of a nation that doesn't exist, serving that nation's God, Israel's king and Israel's God, is going to be our salvation? That sounds ridiculous. But it's what the Gentiles believe. It's what we believe. But it's what the nation has been rejecting. And we find in our text today, one such Gentile placing his faith, he wants to know what the God of Israel has to say about his future. So he sends his official, go find the man of God, go find the prophet, tell me, will I heal from this sickness? And he sends his messenger, Hazael, the man that we're looking for, the man that we expected Elijah to go and to anoint, to put a whooping on Israel. And Hazael goes to meet Elisha in Damascus. He brings all kinds of goods, all kinds of gifts with him in order to incur the favor of Elisha, the prophet. You know, I give you this stuff, you give me a good report, because I know as the man of God, you have some pull with Yahweh, right? So ask from Yahweh, please, that I will be healed. Now, he goes, but when Hazael asks the prophet, you'll notice it in chapter 8, the end of verse 9, he says, look, I need to know, your son, Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, he sent me here. And he wants to know, will I recover from this sickness? And the answer that he receives from Elisha comes across at first glance as somewhat enigmatic. It's a strange answer. You say, what's going on here? Notice it. Verse 10, Elisha says to him, go say to him, you will surely recover. But Yahweh has shown me that he will certainly die. And he fixed his gaze steadily on him until he was ashamed, and the man of God wept. What's he saying? You know what he's saying? He's basically saying, well, it's not the sickness that's going to kill him. I'm looking at you, Hazael. And he stares him down, says, I know what you're thinking, I know what you're scheming, I know what you're planning to do. And Hazael is ashamed. He realizes the man of God knows his intention. He would be fine from this sickness if you weren't going to go back and assassinate him when you get home, Hazael. You know that. Hazael knows if Ben-Hadad doesn't recover, he gets to be king in his place. He's somehow set himself up, even though we have actual archaeological documents from this time period where Shalmaneser III references Hazael as the son of a nobody. He's a nobody, but somehow, through the providence of God, he's worked his way up into this position. And as soon as Ben-Hadad is out of the way, Hazael's going to be king. So he's hoping he doesn't get better, but he's going to make sure he doesn't get better. Now, why does Elisha weep? He's not weeping for this king who's been trying to kill him and trying to destroy Israel, is he? Why is he weeping? He's weeping because he knows that he's preparing the switch. When you guys were young and you got cross with your parents, did they ever make you go and pick out a switch and prepare it to come back and get whooped with? Anybody? Yeah? What was your preference? Did you go for the thinner twig, or did you go for something that was covered a little bit more area so it could distribute the whack? Got to choose, right? Some of that takes experience. You find out which works better. But nonetheless, it's not a fun task. It's not fun to go pick out the switch you're about to get a whooping with, because you know what comes next. And you can't stop thinking about what comes next while you're out preparing that twig. That's how Elisha feels here. He weeps because he knows what comes next. Pick it up, verse 12. Hazael asks him, he says, "Why does my Lord weep?" And Elisha answers, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, their young men you will kill with the sword, and their little ones you will dash in pieces, and their women with child you will rip up." And Hazael says, "But what is your servant, who is but a dog, that he should do this great thing?" And Elisha answers, "Yahweh has shown me that you will be king over Aram." Elisha weeps because he is commissioning God's hand, which is going to judge Israel. And the judgment is going to be severe. It's not just for the leadership. It's for all the people, even the little ones, even the women who are pregnant with child. It's going to be severe. And he weeps. So Hazael, verse 14, departs from Elisha. He returns to his master. He gives the message, "What did Elisha say to you?" "Oh, he told me that you would surely recover." But on the following day, he took the cover and dipped it in water and spread it on his face so that he died. And Hazael became king in his place. They didn't have CSI back then. So if your king was really ill and then you suffocate him, it looks like natural causes. And that's essentially what Hazael does here. A natural cause death. I'm going to suffocate him. Oh, he died. And of course, it's possible he doesn't have time to set his house in order. I mean, he thinks he's going to make it. So nonetheless, Hazael takes his spot. Meanwhile, back to the land of Israel. The king of Judah and the king of Israel have an alliance. Okay? They're trying. Remember, this nation was split because of Solomon's marrying foreign wives that worship foreign gods, turned his heart away from the Lord. He went after foreign gods, so the Lord took the kingdom away from him in his son's time. He split it. Northern kingdom of Israel, southern kingdom of Judah. The Davidic kings are in the southern kingdom. Okay? Now, they're trying, in Jehoshaphat's time, in Ahab's time, they're trying to repair this breach through an alliance. Not through repentance to Yahweh, but they're looking for strength in numbers. Okay, we have a history together. If we can work together, we can better fight off these nations. Okay? So this is kind of like the Montagues and the Capulets of Romeo and Juliet deciding, hey, let's work together and let's arrange a marriage to solidify our alliance. Okay? Now, king of Judah provides a son. Ahab and Jezebel provide a daughter. You remember Ahab's first son. We mentioned him just a short while ago. Ahaziah. He fell through the lattice. He died. They have a second son. His name is Jehoram. You'll also see him mentioned as Joram. Okay, it's the same figure. Name means the same thing. It's just interchangeable. Jehoram. Okay. He also has a sister named Athaliah, and she's going to be the one that's going to marry the prince of Judah, who happens to be named Jehoram. So you have a Jehoram in the north, and you have a Jehoram in the south. And then the sister of the Jehoram in the north, Athaliah, marries the Jehoram in the south. Confused yet? Gets worse. Okay? Now, Jehoram in the south and Athaliah have a child together. Their first son they name after her dead brother, Ahaziah. So whenever Jehoram dies and he's off the scene, Ahaziah takes his place. You're saying, okay, this is confusing. What in the world is going on here? You know, and as we're reading through the text, because the kings in the north and the kings in the south have the same names, at times the reader's saying, you know, I can't really tell the difference. What in the world is going on here? Somebody straighten it out for me. And I think that's the point. It's intentional. It's like the end of George Orwell's Animal Farm. I mean, y'all have to read Animal Farm anytime. It's a story that's kind of paralleling the communist revolution in Russia. And basically it follows an animal revolution led by pigs, okay, in this farm that's called the Manor Farm. And the purpose of the revolution was to create a fair society made for animals that followed animalism. And it was based on seven commandments, such as four legs good, two legs bad. The most important commandment, all animals are equal. And they also eventually they take over the farm, they change the name of the farm from the Manor Farm to the Animal Farm. But by the end of the book, after they've accomplished their goal, the pigs are suddenly walking on two legs. The commandments, the seven commandments, have been condensed into one commandment. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. The sheep are looking at the pigs and saying, four legs good, but two legs better. And the pigs are around smoking pipes and wearing people clothes. And they invite the humans over to play some cards. And they try to they insist to the humans that all they really wanted all along was to live at peace and in normal business relations with the humans. And the animals are looking in at the pigs and the humans playing cards and laughing and discussing at this table. And they find that they can't tell the difference between the pigs and the humans anymore. They can't discern the pigs from the humans. The pigs have become like the humans. And here the same thing is happening in our text. The author is trying to tell us that Judah has become like Israel, and both of them have become like the Gentiles, doing the things the Gentiles do, worshiping the gods that the Gentiles worship. We can't tell the difference anymore. This train has gone off the tracks. It's a mess. But God's preparing His hand to deal with the problem. Okay? How does Jehoram do, Judah's leader? Well, look at it in verse 27. This is verse 27, chapter 9. No, excuse me. Verse 17, excuse me. Verse 17 of chapter 9, Jehoram is 32 years old when he becomes king. He reigns for 8 years in Jerusalem. He's the Davidic king. He's the southern king. He walks in the way of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done. Why? Why would he do this? You don't have to wonder. The text tells us. For the daughter of Ahab became his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. The same poison that got to Solomon, the same poison that got to Ahab, is now making its way to Jehoram in the southern kingdom. Okay? That foreign wise bringing in foreign gods. Jezebel's poisoned Ahab, now she's poisoned the southern kingdom. What about his son, Ahaziah? How does he do? Verse 27. Ahaziah walks in the way of the house of Ahab, and he does evil in the sight of the Lord, like the house of Ahab had done. Now, why would he do that? Because he was a son-in-law to the house of Ahab. See, his mother is Jezebel's daughter. Notice, it didn't matter that both of these guys, you know, Jehoram's father was Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat acknowledged Yahweh. He was the one that would go to battle with Ahab. Ahab's all rearing ready to go and let's do this thing. He says, wait. Is there not a prophet of Yahweh somewhere around that we can ask how this thing's going to go? He's putting the brakes on the thing. Now, he's messing up because he arranged this marriage. He put his stamp on an illegal marriage. He was asking for trouble. But it just goes to show this godly influence did not mean a thing. It didn't mean a thing when your son marries someone who's worshiping a pagan god. It didn't mean a thing. The train went off the tracks. Now, Uncle Joram, the king of Israel, decides to go to war with Hazael, God's hand of discipline. And guess what happens? He gets injured. He gets injured in battle, and then he retreats to Jezreel. He becomes sick because of his injury, and he's like, I got to get out of here. I got to step aside. I got to heal. And while this is going on, Elisha begins preparing the second hand of God. He sends a prophet to the front lines to a commander, one of Jehoram's army named Jehu, to anoint him king over Israel. And not only does he anoint Jehu king over Israel, he gives him a hit list from God. You're going to be king, and you got a lot of work to do. Pick it up. This is what happens. Elisha tells him, take this message to him, anoint him, and then get out of Dodge. And that's what he's going to do. Look at verse 6, the very end. He goes to this captain. He finds him on the front line. He asks him to come aside with him. This isn't a message for everybody. This is for you, captain, in this little house. Let's go together. Follow me. He goes, and he gives him this message. Verse 6 of chapter 9. Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of Yahweh, over Israel. You shall strike the house of Ahab your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of Yahweh at the hands of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab every male person, both bond and free, in Israel. I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. The dog shall eat Jezebel in the territory of Jezreel, and none shall bury her. Then he opened the door and fled. So he comes in, he says, you're the king, your job is to wipe them out. Drain the swamp, okay? Got it? Good. Opens the door, he's gone. Jehu hears this, and he doesn't seem to really be so sure about accepting what the prophet is saying at first. At least that's how it appears. It's hard to tell if he takes him seriously. His men certainly don't. When he brings the message to the men, they're saying, what is this madman saying to you? Verse 11, he comes out to his servants. One says to him, is it well? Why did this mad fellow come to you? I mean, this prophet just shows up, runs, hey, I need to talk to you, talks to him, and they see him, boop, he's out the door and he's gone. They're saying, what's going on with this strange fellow? He says to them, you know the man and his talk. And they said, it's a lie. Tell us now. And he says, well, thus and thus he said to me, thus says Yahweh, I've anointed you king over Israel. And notice their response. Then they hurried, and each man took his garment and placed it under him on the bare steps and blew the trumpet, saying, Jehu is king. Now God's plan has been set in motion. And because of their response, he's emboldened. So Jehu, verse 14, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, he conspires against Joram. He says, if you guys are with me, let's do it. The Lord has prepared his two weapons of mass destruction, the two men who will act as the hand of God to bring judgment on the house of Ahab. He's setting the scene in motion. Now, from this text, I want to cut here and handle the effects of these two men next week. And I want to ask us, as we're looking at these two men now, is serving God's purposes and serving God, is that the same thing? Serving God's purposes and serving God. Joseph's brothers served God's purposes, right? They sold Joseph into slavery. What does Joseph say? What you meant for evil, God meant for good. They served God's purposes, they didn't serve God. Joseph, on the other hand, served the Lord. In fact, he delivered his brothers. He showed them sacrificial mercy. He delivered them from the famine so that the nation could survive in the land of Egypt. In Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 6, Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as God's servant because he served God's purposes by taking Judah into captivity and by subjugating the nations. He served God's purposes. He says, "My servant." He didn't serve God. Daniel, on the other hand, served God in Babylon while he was in the captivity. He's praying three times a day. He's reserving food, kosher laws, in order to honor Yahweh. He's refusing to worship God. To worship Nebuchadnezzar. He's interpreting his dreams so that he'll realize who Yahweh is. Daniel is serving God. In our text, Hazael and Jehu will serve God's purposes by executing judgment on the house of Ahab and on Israel. Will they serve God? Listen to the critique at the end of the story for Jehu. This is just chapter 10. He eradicates Baal, and the Lord blesses him for it. However, verse 29, as for the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, what sins is he talking about when we say the sins of Jeroboam? Idolatry. Remember, he didn't want them to go to Judah to worship in Jerusalem, the place they're supposed to. He set up those two golden calves. He set up his own system of worship. As for the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he made Israel to sin. From these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves that were in Bethel and at Dan. Look at verse 31. Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he had made Israel to sin. There's a lot of people serving God's purposes today. Much less are serving God. They're not the same thing. Do you know the difference, and how do we know where we fall? Paul's going to say in Romans chapter 6, "Do not let sin reign in your mortal body so that you obey its lusts. Do not go on presenting the members of your body to the sin," that self-righteousness, "as instruments of unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God." What is he saying? Present the members of your body to be used as God's members. Execute God's desires for you on earth. After all, we're the church. We are members of His body. The question is, are we participating? So let us live in such a way that when our Lord returns, we can expect Him to see us operating as His body and say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Master."